Anatomy and Physiology, The Senses, Part 2. This is a great gross anatomy photograph to look at. It shows you where we left off last time discussing the accessory structures of the eye. In particular, there's a gorgeous dissection of the extraocular muscles here, and it's just so cool to look at the real deal, so I hope you're enjoying these slides. Next, we're going to look at the eyeball itself. Most textbooks, including your textbook, divides the eye into three general layers, or what we call tunics. Don't let that word freak you out. Tunic just means, in Greek, a coat. Like in college, they used to have parties called tunic parties or toga parties or whatever they were. The bottom line is tunic just means a coat. The three coats of the eye are the outermost tunic or layer, which is mostly made of thin but tough collagen connective tissue fibers that someone called the fibrous tunic. The middle layer, shown in a pinkish red color, is the vascular layer. You guessed it, because it has a lot of blood vessels in it. And the innermost layer, shown in yellow, is the all-important retina. In anatomy, we like to make food examples. I don't know why, but they do tend to help us remember things. So I'm going to make a little sandwich here where my arrow is, and my sandwich goes like this. My outer layer of bread is going to be a stale white piece of bread. That reminds me that the fibrous layer, it's tough, and also, since a lot of it's made of the sclera, we'll see that the sclera is white as well. So that's why I like to use stale white bread as my outer layer on the sandwich. The middle layer, I make strawberry jelly. That's a nice filling for a sandwich. And since it's red, it reminds me that it is the bloody vascular layer. And then the innermost layer, my last layer of bread for the yellow retina, I use a piece of film. Now, you grew up in the digital age, many of you, so you don't know maybe what film is, but cameras actually used to have film in them. There was even a Polaroid camera. When you pushed the button, out came a piece of film with a picture on it. So I like to use film for that layer of bread for the retina, because the retina really is like the film in the camera taking the picture for the eye wherever we look. So make yourself a sandwich, stale white bread, strawberry jelly, and film, and you'll have a good beginning idea of structure and function of the eyeball. Of course, the eyeball is not flat, so you got to curve it around into a ball to get the 3D thing going on. We'll take a look at the fibrous tunic first. This is a drawing showing you the dome-shaped clear cornea in the front, which blends back to the whites of our eyes, that white shell that we'll call the sclera. We'll start on this slide with the cornea. The cornea is the clear dome-shaped front window to the eye. That's what you slap your contact lenses on. That's what you see in the mirror. It's nice and shiny. And one of the reasons it's clear is because there's no blood vessels in it. That is, it is avascular. That brings me to an important point that hooks back with immunology. There's a reason why corneal transplants survive pretty well as compared to other organ transplants in the body. There's no blood vessels in the cornea. There's no lymph vessels in the cornea. So killer T cells can't get there. Antibodies can't get there very well either. So corneal transplants survive very well for that reason. Another reason they're clear is kind of fascinating to me. You don't have to know this, but it's due to the arrangement of collagen fibers. What's interesting is the cornea is crystal clear, and the collagen fibers there are arranged in a parallel sort of direction. Then notice, when you look in the mirror, the cornea goes from crystal clear, then it turns bone white in a fraction of a millimeter into the whites of our eyes we call the sclera. In the sclera, it's just more collagen fibers. It's just that now they're arranged in a crisscross pattern. And just going from parallel to crisscross makes it go from clear to bone white. And that's just amazing to me. Now, when you look in the mirror, you can also see the color part of your eye through the cornea, whether it's green or blue or brown. That's the iris that you're looking at, and we'll talk about that later. So why is the cornea curved? I mean, just for fun? No, the design matches the mission. The cornea is curved so it could bend, or what we call refract, R-E-F-R-A-C-T, refract with a star light to help focus the light, hopefully, on a nice, sharp image on the retina. You should know, and it's nowhere else in the notes, write it down please, that the cornea is the biggest bender, the biggest or most powerful refractor of light in the eye. Many of you thought before today that the lens maybe did most of the focusing, but it doesn't. The cornea is about twice as powerful as the lens, and I want you to know that. So that when light comes through the eye, the cornea does most of the focusing. It comes through the pupil where the lens can then do some more focusing, and hopefully we got a nice sharp image on our retina. I want to talk about a couple of terms you need to know for this course, so please take some notes. Nearsightedness, what is that? It's the most common condition why people wear glasses. Nearsighted means that without glasses or without contacts, people see better at near than at far. That's why they're called nearsighted. The technical name you should know is myopia, M-Y-O-P-I-A. In nearsightedness, the cornea is generally too curved. It's too powerful. So in actuality, when the light comes in the eye, it's actually focused in front of the retina, which is kind of strange. Then there is farsightedness. The technical name is hyperopia, H-Y-P-E-R-O-P-I-A. People who are farsighted without their glasses, they see better at the far or in the distance than they do up near. So, what do people do to try to bring themselves back in focus? Well, you can get glasses or you can get contacts, or of course, now there's surgery, and the surgery is called refractive surgery. Now that you know this a little bit anatomy and physiology, if you wanted to do refractive surgery, if you wanted to refocus someone, where would you want to operate? You would want to operate where you get the most bang for the buck. And where you get the most bang for the buck is in the cornea, because that's the biggest bender of light in the eye. So when they do refractive surgery, like the laser surgery, they work on the cornea. And the laser, basically what it does is it just remolds or reshapes the surface of the cornea by just shaving very thin layers away and hopefully refocusing that image very sharply on the retina. The other part of the fibrous tunic is called the sclera. The sclera is the white of the eye. It is thin, maybe only about a millimeter, but it is tough. Densely packed collagen fibers give it toughness, gives the shape to the eye, and protects the sensitive inner parts of the eye. Let me give you an example of how tough it is. Those of you in lab who already did the eye dissection, notice that even with your blades and your scissors, it was tough to cut through it. It was like cutting through a leathery shell. And I can give you some real clinical examples. When I got called to the ER, I saw people sometimes got stabbed in the eye with a kitchen knife or shot in the eye socket. And sometimes the knife blade would curve between the leathery sclera and the bony socket and bend around the eye, sometimes without harming it. Likewise, sometimes I would see somebody shot and the bullet would skirt between the bony socket and the leathery tough sclera. And on the CAT scan, you would see a perfect lead slug behind the eyeball. Hard to believe that the eye could even survive such a thing. But that shows you how tough the sclera is. Now, don't get me wrong, I've also seen injuries where the eye was splattered to smithereens as well. This is a very special structure you need to know well. It is called the canal of Schlemm. It's fun to say, like some other words we know, like Schwann cell and Nod of Ranvier. You just sound really smart on the weekends when you talk like that. What is it? Where is it? Let's talk about it. This is a picture from your book of an eyeball looking up at the ceiling. Here is the cornea, and then here is the sclera. There is an internal ring-shaped vein. It's a venous sinus located at the junction of the cornea and the sclera. So where the cornea and sclera meet on the inside of the eyeball, there's a ring-shaped vein. And it's a drain. It's a ring-shaped vein drain that you will really call the canal of Schlemm. What's the purpose of the drain? That canal of Schlemm is the drain to the eye, which allows a fluid called aqueous humor to get out of the anterior chamber of the eyeball and into our cardiovascular system. That fluid we call aqueous humor. If we break it down, aqueous just means water. Humor just means stuff. So aqueous humor is just the watery stuff that fills this anterior cavity of the eyeball. We'll learn later on that the aqueous humor is made by these little guys back here. It circulates through the pupil and then hopefully out through the drain to the eye called the canal of Schlemm. Now, what happens as we age is usually fluid is made at a fairly constant rate back here, but the drain to the eye progressively gets plugged up year after year after year with kind of gunk and debris. And if we have the spigot on at a constant rate, but I plug up the drain inside this enclosed hard ball, what's going to happen to the pressure in the eye? Well, it's going to go up, isn't it, if we have a clogged drain? And there's a name for that. It's called glaucoma. I want you to know that glaucoma means high pressure in the eye. And if it's too high for too long, it could crush the nerve to the eye, it could block the blood vessel to the eye, and result in blindness. Usually it happens so slowly and so silently that patients aren't aware of it, and that's why doctors encourage their patients to go for frequent eye checks. And if you've ever been to the eye doctor, you know you either get that puff of air or that blue light comes at you. That's the pressure check. And if the pressure is too high, glaucoma can be treated with drops and pills and lasers and surgeries. And if we catch it early, we can save the vision most of the time. So here's a great question I love to ask on the test, because we're advanced. So here's how it goes. You are the CEO of a drug company or a medical equipment company, and you want to invent a new pill or drop or laser that treats glaucoma, and you want to have this drug or laser designed to target the part of the eye so that you can increase the drainage outflow of the aqueous humor. So on the test, what structure are you going to pick to target with your drug or your laser? And hopefully everyone's going to say the canal of Schlemm. And sure enough, some of the drops and pills you give people to treat glaucoma are designed to help this drain work better. Lasers are used, and I've done hundreds of them myself, and we aim the laser at this canal of Schlemm. And for lack of a better phrase, basically the laser just kind of almost punches hole in the drain or opens the pores of the drain up so it drains better. By the way, if you do invent a new glaucoma drug that works, please remember me and cut me in about 1%. This is a front view. I wanted to show you where the cornea meets the sclera. And right about here where you sometimes see this grayish hue, that is where the canal of Schlemm is. Again, it's on the inside of the eye, so you can't really touch it, but that's about where it is on the inside of the eye. So that's a neat picture to look at. We'll talk about the lens next, and the lens is not part of any of the three tunics by definition, but we have to shove it in somewhere. This is about where your book shoves it in, so this is where I'll shove it in. Here it is highlighted in blue, and a couple of bullet points you have to know. First, note the location. In strict anatomical terms, it is posterior to the pupil and posterior to the iris. Please write that down. It is made up of basically protein. It's just a disc-shaped or frisbee-shaped wad of protein. That's basically what the lens is. And yes, it does refract. It does help to focus or bend the light onto the retina. But is it the most powerful focuser? And you'll say no, because you remember that the cornea is more powerful than the lens. Let's take a minute here to talk about something clinically significant, because you'll hear about this. There's something called a cataract, and all a cataract is a cloudy lens in the eye. As we get older, it gets thicker, it gets darker, especially down here in Florida. The sunlight tends to make it worse. And if we live long enough, we all get cataracts, and it's pretty straightforward to remove them these days. I encourage you maybe to get on the internet and Google some videos about it. It's just, you can watch a 5-minute surgery of a cataract extraction. That's pretty amazing stuff. Let's continue on with the second major layer of the eyeball, called the vascular tunic. Shown here in a light orange color, it consists of the iris, which then blends back into this lumpy, bumpy structure called the ciliary body, which then just continues on and flattens out to this membranous-like structure called the choroid. We'll use this color picture from your textbook to break into a little bit more details. I want to start off by telling you that in real life, nobody calls this the vascular tunic. Everybody calls this middle layer of the eye the uvea. There's even diseases called uveitis. And if you didn't know what a uvea was, you wouldn't know what a uveitis was. It's an inflammation or infection of the uvea. And many diseases show up first as a uveitis. Diseases such as syphilis or Lyme disease or sarcoidosis or various arthritis type diseases. Sometimes I would see that patient with a uveitis and make a diagnosis of one of those diseases before the patient knew they even had it. This is one of the reasons why they say the eye is the window to the body, and it truly is. So what's in the uvea? Well, lots of blood vessels, yeah, because it's the vascular tunic, and also something else that makes it look really dark, and that's pigment. We'll talk about the purposes of the vessels and the pigment later. Once again, the three pieces are on this slide. The iris here in the front, then we get to the lumpy, bumpy place called the ciliary body, then we flatten out back here to this pink structure in the middle of the eye sandwich called the choroid. We'll look at them one at a time, starting with the iris. The iris is the front colored part of your eye. Yes, there's blood vessels in it, and there's pigment in it, of course. That reminds me, a lot of newborn babies have blue eyes, and the parents are all excited. Ooh, I got a blue-eyed baby. But then over about the next 6 months or so, the genetically predetermined amount of pigment kind of fills in and turns it whatever color it's really going to be, which might be green or brown. So that's why babies often start out blue, but over time it changes. What else is in the iris, I want you to know? That's smooth muscle, smooth involuntary muscle. There's a sphincter muscle, and you know what those do. They constrict things. And there's a dilator muscle, and of course that's going to dilate something. Those muscles are important because they regulate the amount of light that gets into the eye through the opening in the center of the iris that is called the pupil. That's right, when you look in the mirror and you see that black circle, that's actually a hole. That's an opening called the pupil. And the muscles can adjust it to make it bigger or smaller to let more or less light in so we can see, you know, better under different lighting conditions. Here's an example. Let's say in the middle here we got a pupil under normal lighting conditions. Then we go into the dark. And in the dark, the pupil dilates to let extra light in so we could see better. I want you to know that that's under control of the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system with a red star on it. How do I remember that? I just remember the sympathetic system is the scared system, and I'm scared of the dark, and my pupils dilate in the dark. Over on the left side, we see a constricted pupil from the sphincter muscles working. And you should know that those sphincter muscles constrict in response to the parasympathetic division of the ANS. So remember, that was our couch potato man, by the way, when we did the autonomic nervous system lecture. This will become relevant also in the emergency room. You notice the nurses and doctors are always checking pupils. In the emergency room, unfortunately, a lot of times we'll see drug overdoses. And it just so turns out, when the pupils are big and dilated, usually that's from excitatory substances such as crack and cocaine. So this is your crack and cocaine pupil that's dilated off to the right. And then over here, this tinier pupil that's more like a pinpoint pupil is usually from people who took drugs that are in the class of substances we call opiates. So opiates make these tiny pinpoint pupils. So that's one way you can kind of tell or get a rough guess right off the bat what your patient overdosed on. So over to your left, we have opium pupils, and over to your right, we got crack pupils. Let's continue on with the vascular tunic. If you follow that iris a little bit posteriorly, it just blends into this lumpy, bumpy structure called the ciliary body, which for our studying pleasure has been divided into two parts, the ciliary processes, and then a muscle inside of there that some genius called the ciliary muscle. We'll look at them one at a time. We'll look at their purposes. First, the ciliary processes are these projections. Remember, a process means a projection. And those processes have two major functions I want you to know. It's those processes that produce the watery fluid we know as the aqueous humor. Second, the processes also help produce these fibers or ligaments that we call zonular fibers, or for short, sometimes we just call them zonules, and they help to suspend the lens. The lens is just not floating around like a flying saucer inside your eyeball. It's held in position by the zonular fibers. Well, let's stop right here and talk about the significance of that. Let's say, once again, you're the CEO of a major drug company. You want to become a multi-bazillionaire. You want to make up a new drop or drug or maybe invent a new laser to treat glaucoma. And the way you want to do it is by decreasing aqueous production. In that case, what specific part of the eye are you going to target? Hopefully, you will pick the ciliary processes. And yes, some drops, some surgeries, some lasers to treat glaucoma are directed at decreasing aqueous production. The target is the ciliary processes. And again, please, if you invent something like that, cut me in just a little bit. I also want to talk a little bit about trauma, because these zonular fibers, they look thin, they are thin. They're fragile, they can be broken. Typical story I used to hear in the ER was I was out behind La Vie La Mine in my own business when some guy just jumped me. Got pounded in the eyeball, and I would go examine them, and the lens was popped loose, what we call dislocated, and just kind of sank to the bottom of the eye. By the way, the real story was always, when the police got there, was he wasn't minding his own business. He was messing with somebody's girlfriend. I heard that so many times in the ER. It's not even funny. But something else here. As you progress in healthcare, you'll learn and build on things. For example, I saw another patient that was just bumped in the eye very lightly. Just someone maybe grazed him barely with his elbow. And I looked in his eye, and his lens was totally dislocated by a minor injury. And there are some things, some diseases that can weaken those fibers. I actually caught a case of syphilis one time by seeing the patient, seeing that they had dislocated their lens from a very minor injury. And I said, wait a minute, I learned in med school that if the lens gets popped out by a minor injury, that could be syphilis. And sure enough, I drew the blood test, made the diagnosis, and got the guy on treatment. So yes, you're learning this stuff, not just for an A, but to help people. Then, the second part of the ciliary body is this smooth muscle, called, of course, the ciliary muscle. And it's that muscle which allows us to change the shape of the lens in our eye so that we could see at different distances. For example, when the ciliary muscle contracts, it allows the lens to wad up into a thicker, more ball-like structure, which is much more powerful and allows us to see the tiny print on the pages. Then when we go to look out the window at maybe some trees or whatever, the ciliary muscle relaxes, it lets the lens flatten out to a much thinner, less powerful structure, and then we can see in the far. Now, when you're young, this mechanism works real good. You can look down at your book and out the window and all over the place. But when we get older, say 45 or so and above, parts start to break. And this is one of the first things to go. And the ciliary muscle gets weak and the lens gets stiff and inflexible. So when we go to read, we really can't crank in that power. So what do? We have to go to the drugstore and get the reading glasses, and every few years you got to change to higher powers, and it's just part of growing old. And there's a name for that, and I want you to know the name for the inability to see up close or decreased ability to see up close with age. It's called presbyopia, P-R-E-S-B-Y-O-P-I-A. It means old eyes or old vision. Last part of the vascular tunic is the choroid. Choroid means membrane, and if you saw it in lab and just traced it right back from the ciliary body, which it connects to, of course, it looked like a flat black-brown membrane. In the old days, it reminded me of something called carbon paper. Most of you don't know what that is, but it's a flat black-brown membrane. And what's in there? Well, the same stuff that's in the rest of the vascular tunic. There's pigment and blood vessels. Why? The design matches the purpose. The pigment that's in the choroid is there to absorb extra or stray light rays, so our eyes are more comfortable and we don't get a lot of glare. I'll give you an example of the patients who have albinism. Albinos are missing pigment sometimes in the eye, and they have to wear sunglasses, even inside. Why? Because when light gets in their eyes, it bounces around like bouncing off a mirror disco ball, like I see hanging off of some of your rearview mirrors in the parking lot. Oh no, that's my car. In any case, that's real uncomfortable. So they have to wear glasses. What about blood vessels? What are vessels for? Same old story. In with the good, out with the bad. The choroidal blood vessels help to nourish the posterior part of the all-important retina. We're about to talk about the last and innermost layer of the eye, called the retina, shown here in yellow. But first I want to mention something about the vitreous. The vitreous is a gel-like clear substance that fills up most of the posterior cavity of the eyeball. If you cut the eyeball open in lab, you noticed a couple of the juices came out. One was like a clear juice. That was a little bit of the aqueous humor from the front part. But most of the back of the eye was filled with gelatinous substance. That's called the vitreous or the vitreous gel. It's mostly made of water, too. It's only kind of thickened up a little bit because there's protein strands or filaments in there. And what happens with time, with age, with certain diseases or trauma, is the vitreous jelly can shrink and collapse on itself. And when it does, the protein strands clump together. And those clumps can get so thick that they actually cast a shadow upon the retina. And people can sometimes see them. I would have people call me up and say, "Doc, I'm seeing these spots in my eyes. As I move my eye, they kind of float around, and they look like gnats or circles or flies or webs or strings," and I heard all kinds of descriptions. And by the way, generically, we just call those floaters, but I told those patients to come in right away, and the reason is this. Imagine you have some molasses, a clear molasses, to represent the vitreous gel. Then the clear molasses is attached to the retina. The retina, if you got a chance to touch it in lab, has the consistency of wet toilet paper. If I let the molasses drip onto the wet toilet paper and pulled on the molasses, do you think I could tear the toilet paper? And the answer is yes. And the biggest cause of a retinal tear or retinal detachment is shrinkage of the vitreous gel. And so when people had floaters, I told them to come in right away. And if I found a tear, tacked them down with laser, hopefully saved them from a retinal detachment, and they were good to go. Finally, we'll talk about the retina. That's the innermost coat of the eye shown here in retina. The primary function is image formation. In other words, it's the film and the camera for the eye, taking the picture for the eye wherever we look. It consists of two basic layers. There's a layer with a lot of pigment in it that some genius called the pigmented layer. And there's a layer with some retinal neurons in it that someone called the neural layer. We'll look at those one at a time in that order. Starting here, before we talk about the retina and the rest of the anatomy and physiology, I have to tell you what your book did. They took a little sliver, a little wedge out of the back of the retina. They sucked it out, blew it up really, 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 really big. So this is a piece of retina that's actually in an eyeball that's looking down, let's say, looking down at an ant on the floor. So that this is anterior and this is posterior. And you've got to understand that in all these figures, that this is an eyeball looking down, to figure out all the anatomy and physiology. So let's take a look first at the pigmented layer. I put a red box around it and an arrow. The pigmented layer is the very posterior part of the retina. And what's its purpose? Well, there's pigment in it for the same reason there was pigment in the choroid. It helps the choroid in absorbing stray light. Also, look what the pigmented layer does. It helps support metabolic processes in the overlying neural retina. In other words, it helps to nourish the neural retina. As a matter of fact, a disease we'll talk about later called macular degeneration, some people think that it starts as a problem with these pigmented layer cells. And if they die off or get damaged, then the overlying retina is going to get damaged as well. So it's one of the things people are looking into to try to help prevent blindness from macular degeneration. Next, we'll look at the neural layer. And the neural layer contains three layers of retinal neurons. We're going to look at them in order from the back to the front because let's get organized here. Again, sliver of retina looking down at an ant on the floor. Here's the front, here's the back. Light comes into the eye from the front to the back. I've highlighted it with a yellow box and a yellow arrow. So light comes into the eye this direction, front to the back, but processing of light goes in the opposite direction from the back to the front. That's kind of weird. So what's the order of the layers of the retinal neurons in the order that the light is processed? It starts with the retinal neurons in the back, the ones that receive the light. They're called the photoreceptors. Next layer of retinal neurons is called the bipolar layer. I like the name bipolar because bi means two, and I remember that it's sandwiched in between the two other layers. And the last layer of retinal neurons is called the ganglion cell layer. And we'll see that that is the order in which the light is processed. Let's talk in detail about the photoreceptors. Of course, that's the Mac Daddy of the cells. It's the cells that receive the lights. There's two kinds of photoreceptors. One, shaped like a rod, that some genius called a rod. And then there's some shaped like cones, that some genius called cones. So we'll look at the rods and cones. First, the rods. What's their purpose? They are specialized for vision in dim light. Let's call it night vision, where we can only see shades of gray. And they're also responsible for our side vision, which technically we'll call the peripheral vision. So, anybody can remember that rods are for night vision and side vision, but how do I ask the question on a test? I might say, your patient has a disease called retinitis pigmentosa, which I will tell you, don't worry, will cause damage of the rods. What problems will your patient have? You will say problems with night vision and problems with side vision. Vitamin A deficiency in third world countries is well known to cause these same symptoms. We almost never see vitamin deficiency in the United States, but it is common in third world countries. These are patients, by the way, that will tell you, I used to be able to go to the movie theater, you know, no problem, but now I got to go in there with a flashlight. These are people who will tell you, I used to go to the bathroom at night, no problem, walk down the hallway, but now I have to feel my way down the hallway and flick on all the lights. You better be suspicious of a disease of the rods. These are people who say, hey, I got T-boned in the intersection 3 times in the past month. Of course, something might be wrong with their peripheral vision, and I've actually saw patients like that, and they had problems with their rods. Often when I talk about this, people ask me in class, well, what happens when you go into the movie theater and it starts out looking real dark and then it kind of seems to brighten up? That's something called dark adaptation. That's actually a period of time where your rods are kicking into full gear. It takes them about 45 minutes roughly to do that, and it's pretty consistent. You'll notice next time you do walk in a movie theater, after about that period of time, you reach your kind of maximum dark vision ability, so to speak. So an interesting point to talk about. As opposed to the cones, what's the purpose of the cones? The cones are responsible for seeing in bright light and also for your central vision or reading vision. So I just have a mental image of somebody, you know, sitting down reading with a lamp on. And I just remember cones with a C, central vision with a C. And also cones are responsible for color vision with a C as well. So it's easy to remember. C for cone, C for central vision, C for color vision. Don't miss it. So if on the test I say your patient has a disease called cone dystrophy, which has wiped out their cones, what problems will your patient have? You will clearly pick off reading vision and color vision. Usually in class, at this point in time, someone asked me about color blindness. Turns out about 6% of men and only about 0.5% of women are born colorblind. That's right, 6 out of every 100 men colorblind. Which reminds me of a true story. Apparently, I wear this outfit that doesn't match. It's kind of a shirt with green and some pants with green in it. And one day I came home from work and my wife said to me, you didn't wear that to work, did you? And I said, no, I changed on the way home just to freak you out. I said, of course I wore it to work. She said, well, it doesn't match. And I said, well, I can't tell. You know, so I'm partially colorblind. And so we have to take it easy on our male patients because 6 out of every 100 can't match up their clothes right. A very important part of the retina we must know by definition is called the macula lutea. Macula means flat. Lutea means yellow. What is it and where is it? This about 1/4 inch orangish looking deal, the very center portion of the posterior retina, that's the macula. All my friends on the weekend, if you want to be in my group, we just call it the macula. And in the middle of the macula is a little divot, a little dimple, a little depression called the fovea. And in the fovea, there's a high density of cones and only cones. And therefore, if anybody ever asked you, it is the area of sharpest vision in the human body. As a matter of fact, the fovea is only about 0.5 millimeter in size. That's just trivial pursuit. I'm not going to ask you to remember that. But that's the only part of our eye that can see to read. As you're looking at fine print on a paper, you're only using about 0.5 millimeter of your eye, the part called the fovea. As you get further and further to the sides, it's more and more peripheral vision. This is a good slide to talk more about something called age-related macular degeneration, or AMD. And it is what it says it is. Unfortunately, about 1 out of 10 of us after the age of 55, we're going to develop degeneration of our macula. And 1 out of 10 of them is going to get the bad form, we call the wet form, where there's leaking or bleeding blood vessels. That is one of the most common causes of blindness. We still don't have a cure. A lot of people working on it. There are treatments, some surgery, some lasers and medicines that help. But it's a devastating disease. Of course, it's a disease that if the macula degenerates, they lose their central vision. These are people that when they look at a person, they can't see their face. They only see everything surrounding the face. So it's very, very frustrating disorder to have. So hopefully someone will come up with a cure for it. Maybe it will be one of you. This is a gorgeous picture. This is what the doctor sees when he or she gets that little wheelie-dealy thing and gets really close to your face and looks in your eyeball. This is what they see. They see the optic disc, this nice yellowish structure we'll talk about. They see the retinal blood vessels and the orangish-looking retina. Of course, the central one-quarter inch posterior part, that's the macula. And the dimple in the middle of the macula, that's the fovea. That's the 1/2 millimeter area of tightly packed cones that allows you to read. That reminds me, when I was in practice, I did a lot of retinal laser surgery to seal up bleeding blood vessels in diabetic patients. And very delicate area to work in, and you have to be very precise. Because, again, the only part of your eye that can see to read is 1/2 millimeter. You want to seal all these blood vessels here, but you certainly don't want to do any damage to that fovea. So very, very delicate and precise surgery. Also on this slide, I want you to notice the coloration, because many of you have noticed when you take a picture of somebody, you see that reddish-orange reflex. That's actually a good sign, because you're seeing the nice, healthy colors of the retina and retinal blood vessels reflecting off the back of the eye. Now that we know all the pieces and parts, let's talk about how it works. We're going to go through the physiology of sight, and this is one of those things where we like to ask questions to have you put it in the right order kind of thing. I know students aren't always so thrilled about that, but it's a question we like, because if you know the parts and put them in the right order, it tells us you know both anatomy and physiology. So be ready for that. Also, remember the setup. This is a sliver of retina blown up big. It's an eyeball looking down and an ant on the floor. This is anterior. This is posterior. This is the direction in yellow of light coming into the eye from the front to the back. But we will see that the light will be processed from the back to the front in the direction of the blue arrow that I've highlighted. So here's how it goes. Light comes to the back of the eyes and is received by the photoreceptors. It is absorbed by pigments, conveniently for my pea brain, called photopigments. So there are photopigments in the photoreceptors, in the rods and in the cones. And all photopigments, whether it's in a rod for gray vision, whether it's in a cone for red, green, or blue vision, all photopigments contain a component called retinal with a star. You gotta know it. Retinal is derived from vitamin A. You must know that. Even Mama knew that. That's why she said, hey, we got to eat a lot of carrots because you'll have good vision. Now, maybe she didn't know this pathway, but she knew that vitamin A was good for your eyes, and she was right. Whenever I get here in this point of course, it reminds me of a true story, because some of the examples I give might seem kind of corny to you, but that's designed to help you remember things. But I was at a meeting one time when I was in practice, and we hired this high-dollar, fancy advertising executive to come up with something for us. He said, I got an idea for your practice. We're going to have a billboard, and on a billboard we're going to have a rabbit. The rabbit's going to have carrots in its mouth, and it's going to say, need good vision, need carrots, you know, need these eye doctors. And I was like, I looked him straight in the eye and I said, dude, that's corny. And I'm thinking to myself also under my breath, I'm paying you how much money and that's all you can come up with? And he looked me straight back in the eye, didn't blink one time, and he said, corn sells. His point was, the cornier things are, as far as memorization techniques, the longer you retain them. It's an age-old thing that the cornier it is, the easier to remember. So I just want you all to know that at home I'm normal. My corny examples are just for you to help you. So what happens after the light is absorbed by the photopigments? The retinal in the photopigments undergoes a structural change. Think of it like snapping a stick. When you snap a stick, you kind of create a spark. So the retinal snaps when the light hits it. It makes a spark, so to speak. And those electrical signals, which develop in the rods and cones, then leads to excitation of the next cell in the chain, which you know is the bipolar cell. When you excite the bipolar cell, that excites the next cell in the chain, which you know is the ganglion cell. And when you depolarize or excite the ganglion cells, they initiate nerve impulses, action potentials, which travel along their axons. Those axons are actually the wires that form the beginning of the optic nerve, which exit the eyeball at a disc-shaped structure called the optic disc. And I think I got another visual on that, and here it is. It's just hard to fathom this. You're looking at a retina again. There's about 120 million rods, about 6 million cones. They all funnel their information to about a million ganglion cells. Those ganglion cells, those retinal neurons, funnel over 1 million axons, right? The optic nerve beginnings. They funnel them through this about 1.5 millimeter disc-shaped structure called the optic disc. Just hard to believe you got like a million fibers going through something the size of about 1.5 millimeters. But we're not done yet, because seeing is not just the eyeball. Seeing is also the brain. You can't just see with eyeballs, you have to have a brain. Off to your right, a beautiful inferior view of a human brain. Looks kind of like a sheep's brain. Then we have a flow chart that has too many details for our course, so you could just relax on that. But off to the left is what you do need to know. Once the optic nerve exits the back of the eyeball, it travels to the crossing point that you know is called the optic chiasm, where only about half the fibers cross. Please, for my course, I do not want you to think that the right one crisscrosses total to the left side and the left one crisscrosses total to the right side. About half the optic nerve fibers stay on the same side and half of them cross to the opposite side of the head. From there, from the optic chiasm, they go to the thalamus. Remember the relay station in the brain with a red star on it. That's where the optic nerve technically ends. The thalamus then shoots out its own fibers, which carry the electrical signals eventually to the part of our brain that can actually interpret what we saw. And that part of the cerebrum has a star next to it, because you should remember it from our brain studies. Please write down the occipital lobe if you forgot where the visual areas are, because that's where the electrical signals are eventually going so we can actually tell what we just saw. And that is the complete visual pathway. I have another slide here. It's too advanced, really, I think, for our course. For those of you who go deeper into healthcare, this might help you as a reference. But for the rest of us, we could just take a look at this slide and think it's pretty and move on from there.